and a lot of sticks in the clay that you're molding, but I want the Lord to do something with me. Well, we're going to take one of Ezekiel's visions tonight. I want you to go with me to chapter 8 of the book of Ezekiel. Chapter 8. The book of Ezekiel sometimes is a hard book. Boy, when it starts with those descriptions, you see, I come from an interpretation background or foundation where I just, when I read the Bible, I try to read it literally. Just like you read a newspaper, just like you read a magazine, just like you read an article on the internet. So when we're reading our Bible, we ought to come to it when the literal sense makes sense, seek no other sense. But there are times when there are things that are allegorical. And Ezekiel has got quite a few of those. I was telling the preacher, I said, I think it'd be a great series to preach on the visions of Ezekiel. I think there's seven of them, where that you would take maybe one each week and just preach on it for a while. Well, tonight I want to preach out of chapter 8, which is only one part of his vision. It's the vision that has to do with judgment. Our text verse is going to be found in verse 17. We will mention more of the chapter, but I want you to look with me at verse 17. Then he said unto me, "Hast thou seen this, O son of man?" In other words, it's a rhetorical question. He's not really asking him. He said he knows he's seen it. "Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their nose." The title of the message tonight is "A Branch to Their Nose." 400 years earlier, the Temple of Solomon was complete. They had dedicated the temple. There was much pomp, there was much circumstance. God was pleased with it, and the presence of God indwelt that temple. It would hover over the wings of the cherubim that were touching or almost touching above the Ark of the Covenant. And the presence of God was there. It says of the presence of God over in Chronicles, it says this, that the glory of God was so powerful that the priest could not even go in at times and minister, because it was so presence, such a presence that was there. And it was just a magnificent thing, and people would say, "God is in Israel." We had a guy named George. He told me, he said, "You need to remember this. When you pray in Israel, it's a local call." And I thought that was pretty humorous, because I believe God is everywhere, of course. But I'm telling you, there's something special about it. And so God's presence was in the land of Israel. God's presence had been in that temple. But over the centuries, four centuries had now passed, and little by little, they began to creep into their sin. They left the glory that was once God's, and they began to take the glory of worship and that adoration that they were giving to God, and they began to ascribe it to other deities. They began to worship in the groves. It wasn't long before there was civil war that broke out, and you had the nation of Israel divided into two halves, the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom went into captivity with the Assyrians in 722 BC, and a little over 100 years later, Then the south, which is called Judah, the Babylonians conquered them. They took, on three different occasions, people into captivity, and that's where the book of Ezekiel comes in. You've got a man named Ezekiel. He is a priest slash prophet. And he is sitting with the elders, and all of a sudden, the good hand of God falls upon him. It comes upon him. Throughout the book of Ezekiel, you'll find that statement that is said about Ezekiel. The hand of God fell on me. And I want to tell you something, that when God's hand reaches down and touches you, you sit up and pay attention. Yes. It's not something that you just kind of slough off. I think about when God convicted me of my sin. I knew for years that I was lost. I knew that if I died, I would have gone to hell. But then there came a time when it seemed that the heavy hand of God began to weigh on my mind more and more, and it got to bothering me, and conviction fell upon my soul. And I began to think, I'm going to hell, and I'm going soon. And so when God wanted to get my attention, he was able to get it. And it wasn't just a few days. It was a Sunday morning, and I thought, I've got to have it settled today. And I had my youth pastor take me through the scriptures. Before Sunday school ever started, I got saved. Amen. Why? Because God got my attention. And many of you can share the same experiences about God getting your attention, and how that you knew that God was calling you to salvation. You also knew that there were times when God was calling you to do a specific thing. And this is exactly where we find Ezekiel. And so as we have looked at this text verse, I want us to understand that the Babylonians are now in charge. They have pillaged the temple. They've taken the instruments of worship. I don't know what they've done. They've probably taken them and put them into their temples of their pagan gods. The reason I say that is because if you read the book of Daniel, you'll find that Belshazzar called for his servants to go and get the instruments out of their temple, and they began to use those instruments to worship that the ancient Israelites used to worship Jehovah with. They began to use them in a debauchery party. And all of a sudden, the hand of God began to write on the wall and said, tonight your kingdom will be taken from you. Well, before that happened, what we have is we've got the Babylonians in charge. They have taken everything of value. They have desecrated the place of God. And now the people of God have in Jerusalem, they have begun to have this thought. God doesn't care about us. We'll find us another God. And this is where we're at. And so all of us have probably heard the word Ichabod. How many of you in your English literature have ever heard of the character named Ichabod Crane? He was named after the Bible word Ichabod. And it means the glory of the Lord has departed. And so tonight, I want us to think about this chapter. Again, the vision goes chapter 8, 9, 10, and 11. And ultimately, the glory of God is going to depart. And it's a progression. And I can't help but think in our own country how that just a few months ago, there was such angst. There was a lot of fear about the future. I know there were days that I would come to the office early in the morning and I would pray and I would read my Bible. And to be honest with you, I did not have much optimism. But then it seems as though that maybe God gave us a little reprieve. What I hope is that we don't get cocky. I hope we don't get arrogant to the point to where we say, look what we are doing. I sense there's an optimism in certain parts of the country right now. And my prayer is that we will not be like the nation of Israel, because it took them centuries to begin to have their own country again. It didn't happen until about 2,500 years later. Well, I want you to see the progression of the glory of God departing. Look with me at chapter 9, verse 3. And the glory of Israel, or the glory of God of Israel, was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. So you have the cherub, and the glory of God has now left where those wings would touch. And he has moved to the threshold. No longer is he where he had been for those hundreds of years. God's glory has now moved a little bit. Look with me at chapter 10. Look at verse 4. Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with a cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the Lord's glory. So what you have is, you've got the glory moving from the cherub to the threshold to outside in the courtyard of the temple. But then look at chapter 11 and verse 23. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst, or the middle of the city, and stood upon the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. You have the picture of the glory of God moving from the cherub to the threshold to the outer court to the middle of the city, and now on the highest peak of the Mount of Olives, you have God there. And the teaching is very simple. Ultimately, God will not dwell in a place where he is not worshiped. He will not dwell where he is not honored, even among his own people that he had called out from the least of all the nations of the world. And so you have God, the last thing we see is him heading over the Mount of Olives. At one time, they would take that ark into battle, and the presence of God would be so powerful, no enemy could stand before them. And now, they're worshiping other gods. I want you to look with me at chapter 8. Let's begin in verse 1. And it came to pass in the sixth year, and in the sixth month, and the fifth day of the month, as I sat in mine house, and the elders of Judah before me, that the hand of the Lord God fell there upon me. If you were to translate the sixth year, sixth month, fifth day of the month, it comes out to September the 17th, 592 BC. You say, how did you calculate that? I didn't. I had somebody else do it. But when you translate their calendar, the Jewish calendar, with the dates and the days that he's given, that is our calendar if we were to use it. And that is the date of this vision that Ezekiel has. And so, if you look, you see the hand of God falling upon him. And this is the likeness. It says, there was a likeness as the appearance of fire. Talking about a man. And from the appearance of his loins downward, fire. From his loins, or his waist area, upward, the appearance of brightness as the color of amber. And verse 3 is a verse that just, in some ways, it's kind of funny to me. If it were me that he was doing this to, he'd have to do it by the ears. And he put forth the form of a hand and took me by a lock of mine head. And the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem. Now remember, where's he at? He's in Babylon. He's in captivity. But yet in his vision, he is transported by the hair of his head. And they take him to the door of the inner gate that looks toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provoketh to jealousy. Verse 5 talks about the image of jealousy. Say, what in the world would that image be? We don't really know. There's some ideas, and I'm going to give you the most popular idea in a moment. But what had taken place was this. The people of God had basically taken God's sanctuary and turned it into a pagan altar. There was an image of jealousy. You know, say, well, why does he call it an image of jealousy? The Bible tells us that God is a jealous God. He won't share his glory with anybody. The Bible tells us also in the Ten Commandments, we're not to have any type of images. And so these people that claim to be the people of God, they have set up these images at the entrance in verse 5. Well, he begins to talk again, and he said, furthermore unto me, son of man, seest thou what they do? Even great abominations that the house of Israel committeth here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary. So in other words, they have gone from living out in the wilderness. They'd gone from having their altars underneath the trees up in the mountains. Now they have moved literally into the house of God for their paganism. They're willing to do whatever they want to do. Why? Because they don't think God's around. They don't think God cares. Well, in just a little bit, we're going to see that that's 180 degrees from the truth. And so, God looks at him and he says, but turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations. In this one chapter, three times, that little phrase is used. Thou shalt see greater abominations. In other words, you think that's bad? Let me show you this. Well, he brought me to the door of the court. And I looked. Behold, a hole in the wall. And he said unto me, son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I had digged in the wall, behold, a door. And he said unto me, go in. And behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So I went in and I saw. And behold every form of creeping things, an abominable beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel. The house of what? Not the house of the Assyrians. Not the house of the Phoenicians. Not the house of the Egyptians. It's the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. These people at the entrance had set up an image of jealousy, which most commentators believe, or at least the popular interpretation is, the goddess Ashereth. She was a consort, I guess would be the pleasant way of saying it, with the ancient pagan god of Baal. And so you have the female deity, Ashereth. He goes farther into the temple, and all of a sudden, there's all type of carvings. There's all type of drawings that are on the walls. And most people think that it's probably pornographic. You say, why do you say that? Well, because when you begin to read the description, it talks about the abominable beast and the creeping things and the idols. Does that not go along with Romans chapter 1? And when you get to Romans chapter 1, you have idolatry and you have immorality and you have perversion. You have all types of things, and they all go together. We'll see that here in just a little bit more. And so he says, you're going to see greater abominations than what I'm showing you. And so you have these portraits on the wall, these drawings, these carvings on the wall, and they're everywhere in God's house. And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel. Let me tell you what that's equivalent to. Let's say that there was a vision and God sent somebody in this room here. And they look around and all along the walls, you've got these carvings, you've got these drawings, and basically it's just pornography. And then you've got 70 deacons. And what are they doing? They're just hanging out. These are the leaders of Israel here, just like a deacon would be one of the leaders of our church. And so you've got these ancients, and in the middle of them stood Jezaniah, the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Everybody is worshiping at these drawings that are around the room. The censers are so thick with smoke that it's everywhere. I mean, the entire room is just full of incense smoke. Well, then he said unto me, Son of man, have you seen what the ancients in the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, the Lord seeth us not. The Lord hath forsaken the earth. And he said unto me, turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Well, they're already pretty bad. I mean, at the entrance, there's the image of jealousy. And now they've got these images around the wall. So what else are they up to? Well, he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Somebody says, who in the world is Tammuz? Was that one of their heroes in Israel? No. It was a Babylonian god. He was an agricultural god of fertility. They looked at Tammuz as the god that would bless their crops. They looked at Tammuz as the god that would bring produce and bring it abundantly. They didn't look at the God of heaven, which had blessed their nation above all other nations. No, they've done cast Jehovah aside. And now they've got a Babylonian deity called Tammuz. Well, why are these women weeping? Because in the mythology, Tammuz would die in certain times of the year, but then he would resurrect. And one of the things that they would do in their worship of Tammuz is they would weep when he died. And the women to say, he must come back alive, would even offer themselves in prostitution as a way of saying, he is the God we serve. And so these women are sitting at the door and they're weeping for Tammuz, the fertility god. He said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. The third time he says that. He brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, There were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, their faces toward the east. And notice the next phrase. And they worshiped the sun toward the east. They weren't worshiping God. They're worshiping the sun. Baal was a sun god. And so you've got Asherah. You've got all of the carvings that have now placed on the wall. You've got 25 guys now that are facing with their back to the temple, and they're looking at the sun. The whole place is just rife with paganism. And he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit this abomination which they commit here? Well, our text verse is what we started out with. And it says, lo, they put the branch to their nose. What does that mean? What does it mean? Well, in Hebrew, there is a term called an idiom. And basically, it's kind of a saying of speech. And you know what it means, or it's an action that you do and you know what it means. How many of you have ever heard the term to thumb your nose at something? Okay? How many of you have ever had somebody that flipped you off? You know what I mean by that? You know, giving you the old Hawaiian good luck sign? Many years ago, I had taken a group of people somewhere on one of the buses that we had. And I'd been driving pretty much all day. I guess we'd probably been on the road for 8 or 10 hours, and I was just tired. And I dropped this group off. Now I was just trying to get back to the church, get that bus put in that bus barn, and go home, get a shower, and just rest. I was tired. I was irritated. I'm coming around West Park Place by the Wendy's, just where it runs into the Rockbridge Road next to the old church. And I'm in this Silver Eagle bus, and I come around, and there's two lanes there. Right lane, left lane, that the people coming this way from the other side of 78 can turn on. Well, as I turn in, these two guys didn't like the fact that I turned into that lane, so they couldn't come all the way over. And one of them flipped me off. And it just fired me up. And I started honking the horn, and I started screaming. They couldn't hear me. I'm screaming through the windshield, come on back! And I mean, I'm noticing, and he's looking at me, and I'm saying, come on, come on. Here, I'm in a church bus. You know? I'm on the staff of the church. And I'm ready to whip two men right there at the Wendy's restaurant. You know why? Because he gave me a sign, and I knew what that sign meant. When it says that they put the branch to their nose, this is what they were doing to God. In other words, no respect whatsoever. They were dishonoring God. Well, what does God say he's going to do about it? Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eye shall not spare. Neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. The first part of this vision, God is about to judge them because of the way that they are treating him. I don't believe that people in Christianity today, I don't believe that the majority of us would intentionally do what these people have done. I don't think there's one single member of the Corinth Baptist Church that would worship at an entrance of a door an image of an Ashereth. I don't think that there would be any of you that would go to a museum anywhere. And if you saw nothing but a hall or an exhibit of nothing but pagan art, I don't think that you would begin to offer any type of worship at that. You may look at that and you may think, well, that's paganism. But you wouldn't worship that. I don't think that there's any of you that would worship the sun. Now, I think there's people that stay out in the sun too long. I think I probably have been in the sun over the years too long without wearing hats. And about twice a year, I have to go to a dermatologist, and they usually light my head up. I don't think that we would have anybody that would worship the sun, though. Now, there are people in our country that would. There's fruitcakes everywhere. All right? But did you know that anything that we put in our lives before God is an idol? What about family? Did Jesus not say that if I don't mean more than mother and father, you're not my disciple? Does that mean we're not supposed to like our parents? No, it just means we're supposed to like Jesus more. You say, well, what about, you know, I mean, I like materialism. Well, money can be a god. Scriptures tell us that the love of money is the root of all evil. And so money, materialism, people, all of those can lead us to idolatry. And so as we look at this first part of this vision, I want you to know that Ezekiel was simply seeing what God was showing him, and it was the heartbeat of God. God was crushed. And when we don't give the Lord first place in our lives, we crush God. We ought to make sure that everything is about God. Now, let me give you two thoughts, and these are actually two lies that people believe. These people believed it, and people today still believe it. And I'll give you the answers to both of these lies, how to refute it. Number one, God doesn't see us. When you begin to look, they're just thinking, God doesn't see what we're doing. I mean, after all, you know, he's not even looking at us. Well, the scriptures teach us in Genesis that God saw the imaginations of the heart, and they were only continually evilly, they were evil continually. Not only that, David, in teaching his young son Solomon, he said, Solomon, I want you to remember something, boy. He said, God searches your heart. And so lie number one is this, that God doesn't see us. Do you know one of the things that God showed Ezekiel? What these fellows were doing in the dark. You know, it's almost like a little child. And you'll cover them up with a blanket and go, where did they go to? And they think it's so funny because you can't find them. When in reality, they just think you can't find them. You know where they're at all the time. And when we do things in the privacy of our own minds, in our own lives, And we think, God doesn't see it. Sure he does. I told a humorous story two or three times about the lady that came to church drunk. And she came forward during the invitation, and the preacher said, "What can I do for you?" And she said, "I need prayer." And he began to pray. He said, "Dear Lord, this lady's drunk." And she said, "Shh, don't tell him that." She didn't want God to know. He already knew it. The second lie is this, that God has forsaken us and doesn't care what we do. That's a lie. Did you know that our God is a personal God? He is personally involved in our lives. What does it say about how observant God is in the scripture? Well, there's not one little sparrow that hops along the ground that he doesn't see. Every one of you, God knows how many hairs are on your head. Now, you could count mine pretty easily. But you take somebody like Brother Don or Brother Bill. Boy, they got a nice head full of hair. God knows how many's there. And whenever one of them falls out, he knows when to subtract one. He knows it all. And so God has not forsaken us. He is ever with us. And because of his mercy and because of his grace, let's don't put the branch to the nose and get our focus on something else. Let's don't thumb our nose at God. Let's don't have, and I'm about to meddle, let's don't have another God that's more important than our God, a God such as football. And I'm all for the Falcons. And by the way, I don't have any idea if they won, and don't tell me because I know you've been reading your phone in church. But before church started, it was 45-15, Falcons. And I'm happy about that. But I want to love God more than I love the Falcons, even if they go to the Super Bowl and win the Super Bowl. Will I be happy about it? Yeah, it'll be great. But God ought to be first and foremost. Yes, sir. He ought to be the one that gives us our joy. Why? Well, he's just taken us to heaven. He's just given us eternal life. He's just meeting our daily needs. Let's don't put the branch to the nose. Let's put God first, okay? Let's stand together.